it's in the breaking, we come unbound. And it's in the giving, we are found. Yeah, you can barely change.
Welcome to A Medicinal Mind, Wisdom and Well-Being, a podcast dedicated to the telling of authentic stories and the sharing of insightful wisdom, exploring science and spirituality, medicine and Mother Nature. No topic is off limits when it comes to growing our personal understanding and supporting our collective well-being. With your host, Dr. Rob Abbott, a family medicine resident practicing spiritually focused and evolutionarily informed functional medicine, we hope to nourish your being so that you can flourish in whatever the moment has called for you to do.
And I know you try.
In episode 36 of A Medicinal Mind, Wisdom and Well-Being, I welcome the founder and innovative voice behind evidence-based birth, Rebecca Decker. Dr. Decker received her Master of Science in Nursing and her Doctor of Philosophy in Nursing from the University of Kentucky and has built a strong reputation in maternal and infant health circles for her pioneering work as the founder of evidence-based birth. In our podcast, Rebecca shares her personal story of childbirth, the true origins behind the birth, pun most certainly intended, of her research and greater work with evidence-based birth. Rebecca offers her insights into the evolution of pregnancy and the birthing experience, sharing her passion for putting practical evidence about childbirth into the hands of families and professionals with the ultimate desire to empower and educate all curious enough to explore. The conversation is spilling over with Rebecca's passion and drive for holding nourishing spaces for mothers and their families to discover what they really need to support themselves and baby-to-be. We explore some of Rebecca's newest groundbreaking work, expanding the content and reach of evidence-based birth, and even discuss the role patients can play in helping to appreciate and understand the burdens clinicians face in trying to provide compassionate care to all patients. It was such an honor to share this time with Rebecca, and I really believe, no matter your background or interest in childbirth, that you will enjoy this conversation. Many thanks again to your continued support, our audience, of this podcast and work at Medicinal Mind. We really appreciate all of your support and extend back our appreciation and love for you in this, our St. Valentine's Day podcast. And with that, let's dig into the show. Rebecca, thank you so much for taking a few minutes out of your day to share a conversation with me today.
No problem. I'm delighted to be here.
So let's just really jump in, and I want you to start by just, you know, giving a little introduction to our audience with sharing a little bit of your background and perhaps why we're having this conversation today.
Sure. So I grew up near Memphis, Tennessee, and I went to school in college in Michigan, where I got my nursing degree, went into nursing, but knew that I wanted to get my doctorate someday. So I moved down to Kentucky with my husband, and I got my master's and my doctorate in nursing. And as I was in the process of getting my doctorate, I got pregnant with my first baby, and I was about 2 years away from finishing. And we were really excited to have our first baby. And I had not worked in labor and delivery. I had actually worked in medical surgical nursing. And then in my doctoral program, I was mainly focused on research. I was getting my PhD, which is a research-focused degree. So doing a lot of work on clinical trials. At the same time, I was also teaching nursing students. So I was really kind of enmeshed in this whole world of evidence-based practice. It was like the gold standard. It was what we taught our nursing students. I was working on generating evidence. Like that was my job. So when I got pregnant, I intentionally didn't really do a lot of research. I kind of really wanted to trust the professionals who'd be taking care of me. So I basically kind of said, I'm going to let them kind of run the show. I just want to be a compliant patient. Because I was really worried and nervous about being a nurse myself, I didn't want the healthcare staff in the hospital to not like me. Like I really wanted to be liked. Had to do with me being pregnant and kind of feeling vulnerable. So I just wanted to be labeled as like an adherent, compliant patient. And I kind of went into it with that attitude. But what I didn't realize is that I was basically giving up all control. And when you do that, sometimes in the healthcare system, you end up getting a lower standard of care or lower quality of care because as we all kind of know, our healthcare system has a lot of malfunctioning parts and pieces.
A couple.
The maternity care system is one of those, you know, malfunctioning parts. So what I was basically setting myself up for was kind of lower standard care.
You know, it's interesting you bring up two big points. One is that, you know, I think if you're in the medical profession as a clinician and then you're wanting to seek care in some, you know, some way, whether you're a nurse or, you know, a physician, it's really hard to be that patient. And sometimes it's, I think, like you just mentioned, easy to say, well, I'm just going to give it all up and trust my colleagues, right? Because I would trust myself, wouldn't I? And go into it willing to be adherent and trusting, but at the same time, wanting to still kind of dictate what care, who is giving your, you know, care and to what direction. And it's a very hard balance to navigate. So it's interesting that, you know, you initially chose to kind of give up some of that and with that trust in mind. And it sounds like maybe you were,
I kind of assumed that the care I would get would be evidence-based, right? Because that's what I was so enmeshed in that world. It just didn't cross my mind that things might happen to me that weren't based on evidence and that I would be pressured into things that were more based on tradition. So I just, like I said, I was pretty naive. So what ended up happening is I was having a normal, healthy pregnancy and labor, but when I got to the hospital, I was immediately treated as if I was sick and I was told that I had to follow all these rules, like I wasn't allowed to get out of bed, not even to use the bathroom. I wasn't allowed to eat or drink. I had to have all of these different monitors and IVs and I was hooked up to all kinds, you know, the blood pressure cuff, the pulse ox, and I was basically tied to this bed and I knew something was wrong intuitively, but I didn't want to question what was being done to me. And it wasn't actually until like maybe a year later that I really started to process everything because I found that that's pretty normal. Wow. When I talk with people who had a baby, that sometimes it's not till a year later and they really start processing what happened to them if they experienced any kind of trauma. And the main thing that was traumatizing for me was at the time there was routine separation of the babies from the mother. Yes. So they took, even though I had a vaginal birth, they took my baby away to the nursery for observation. And we were both healthy. There was no reason for us to be separated. And I kept pushing my call light button, like asking for them to bring her back. And they didn't. And my husband went and took pictures of her through the nursery window. And she was just laying in the isolette. And there wasn't even anybody in the room with her most of the time. So she wasn't really being actively observed or taken care of. And that really bothered me. I knew that wasn't evidence-based because I figured that there's no research that would support like separating a mammal from a newborn from its mother in those first hours of life. But I just kind of was curious about everything else, like, you know, in particular, not being allowed to eat and drink. I was pumped full of IV fluids for hours and hours because I ended up having a longer labor. And I had a lot of edema. I had 3+ pitting edema after the birth for the next week. And so I was just really curious, like, what the evidence said about all of these different things. And so I basically made like a bullet point list and was like, I'm going to start looking at the research and digging in, because I had access to all the research and I knew how to understand it. And so I was just kind of just surprised that almost everything that happened to me has been shown by evidence to either be unnecessary or harmful to healthy pregnant people. And it just kind of blew my mind that that was what was actually happening all around the country as well. And then you look at other countries, and a lot of times they admire the US system. And so they kind of copy a lot of what we do. And some countries do and some don't, but I was just really starting to realize that what I had experienced was actually the norm around much of the world. And it really inspired me to look for something different.
Well, I will certainly say, having just come across your work with evidence-based birth rather recently, it's amazing to see that calling starting to come to light, to share with such a wider audience. It's amazing. I'm just imagining you in those moments. There's no way you could have thought your sort of career would have gone in this trajectory, and yet this sort of experience, this relative traumatic experience, you kind of grew from it and found this inspiration, and you've helped so many women. And I think on both sides, you have so many resources that sort of are helping to empower and educate, women and their partners, their families, as well as the clinicians, to help, open their eyes. And, I know for myself, as a new family medicine resident and with a relatively sort of open perspective, I have, very little experience, and I want to try to keep an open mind. It's been very refreshing to see some of the resources that you've provided, and it's given me a lot of, education and talking points to provide to my patients when I see them in the hospital. And I feel at least a little bit better prepared for some of the tougher conversations. And I feel like I have a bit, at least an open mind when it comes to care. So I was curious, if we wanted to, if you wanted to, offer just a sort of a general overview of what exactly, when I refer to these resources, what have you been providing this space to help empower women and as well, and even teach clinicians?
Yeah, so I've started with blog articles, which were basically reviews of the literature on each topic. And I have to hate to say it, but it was kind of selfish in the beginning because I wanted to know the research for myself. And I figured, what better way to do it than just to start doing systematic literature reviews on each of these topics? Because my goal at the time, I decided I wanted to shift research fields and do more research in the maternity care field as a PhD prepared nurse. And I thought, well, I need to understand the literature. So I started just doing these literature reviews, kind of writing up summaries and then posting them on my blog. And very quickly, I realized that there really wasn't anybody else doing it like the way I was doing it. Almost like creating like a current encyclopedia of all the research on birth and making it free and available to the public. And so as traffic kind of took off and the website became popular right away at evidencebasedbirth.com, I realized that there are people all over the world reading these articles. And so I really needed to take a step back. And I was like, at first I was just kind of writing these articles for myself. And then I realized, okay, if people are reading these, I need to make sure they're really high quality. So I decided to take a core group of a bunch of the articles that I had written and that I was writing, and started sending them off to physicians and midwives and researchers to peer review them. So almost like you would with a journal, but this is like a journal for the public. Like, there are articles written so that any mostly college educated person could read them. It might be they're written at a kind of a higher level, but a level that any lay person, so you wouldn't have to be a physician or a nurse, could read them.
Yeah.
And so we have about 15 of those articles on these like kind of core important topics, like eating and drinking during labor, having IV fluids during labor. There's a bunch of other topics that have all been peer reviewed. And they've gone through multiple revisions. So every couple of years we update them. And then those are available for free on the website. And then last year I started really wanting to get into video. So I started doing these shorter videos that we put on blog posts. So we have a YouTube channel. We just started a podcast at Evidence-Based Birth, and I'm hoping to write a book eventually. So those are kind of all of the ways we're reaching out to the public.
It's so beautiful to me to think of this sort of mosaic of your, you know, research background, that sort of clinical research training, and how you took those tools to sort of kind of reinvent and almost create a new sort of genre to, you know, educate and in the same way sort of bring some of the evidence, the literature, to a lay audience. And it's something that, you know, I start to look around and at what's being produced in the sort of health and wellness space. And there's a lot of people seeking to, you know, empower people with a high degree of sort of science embedded in their work. And for some, it can be a little intimidating because it's certainly a lot more work to go through that than just to kind of, you know, piece together anecdotal, you know, commentary. And I'm just, you know, really grateful and impressed that you've gone through sort of that rigorous process. But at the same time, kind of doing it for this sort of open access and really accessible to a wider audience, because realistically, I mean, that's who we're trying to help in the grand scheme of things. So I
Yeah, there's room for that in all sorts of fields. Like, I get a lot of people ask me if I would do the same thing for like fertility treatments. I mean, if you can imagine being a fertility patient, the amount of information is so confusing and overwhelming. Yeah. And there's really no one good website where you can go to as a patient or consumer and see what's the evidence on all of your options. And, you know, without people telling you what to do, but just saying, here's the evidence, go talk with your doctor about all of this research that's coming out. We've summarized it for you. I mean, that could be done in any area of healthcare. And I think you're right. It is a new genre. And it really is, I think, the way of the future is that consumers want to have accurate information. I mean, there's so much, you know, bad information out there.
Yes.
And it's so hard to filter. You know, with social media, you could just post something and claim that it's true and people will believe it. And so I think, you know, it's just really important when you're making decisions about your own body and your own baby that you're pregnant with, that you make those decisions with good information. And it's hard to find sometimes. So if you take any random topic about childbirth and Google it, a lot of times more than half the info you get on the first page of Google results, sometimes 90% of it is going to be bad.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's I think it's a really fun, and I have to say, I think I was a little bit crazy to do it because
yeah, seriously.
I'll tell you, one of those articles I could have spent 100 hours on, but it was all like I was working full time at the time I was doing this. So obviously I didn't do it during work hours. So I was doing it like every weekend and every night. And every time one of my kids had a movie night, instead of reading a book or relaxing myself, I was like reading research and writing. And it was basically working around the clock. So I was really fortunate finally about a year and a half ago to be able to quit my job. So I'm no longer an assistant professor, and this is my full-time life. And it's definitely a calling. Like I think the only reason I was so obsessed with the research was because of those experiences that I had as a consumer in the system. And I was just really driven to help make change and to make an impact and to try and take this research and make it publicly accessible.
Yeah. Wow. You know, I was just joking to a friend earlier today, you know, when you get so passionate about an area, and we were specifically talking about, you know, sort of integrative medicine or something a little bit beyond what your sort of traditional training might be, on the surface, it seems like, why would you spend all that extra time doing it? There's so much effort that needs to go into that. And it's easy to say no, but when that calling hits you, you know, you find the time, whether it's, you know, during these movie nights or, you know, I've given up, like, I can't even remember the last time I like watched anything on TV, just because like, I want to read and spend time writing. And, but you just make those commitments and you're motivated to offer and really just stay curious and explore. So, I completely agree. And, you know, recently I was just reading one of my favorites, of these sort of new articles was an article when you were describing basically pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic therapies for pain management during labor. And I was just one that really stuck out in my mind, given my sort of background and just, you know, mind-body practices and sort of the cultivation of mindfulness and really trying to help patients engage with the experience. I even, you know, as a third year medical student, did a sort of presentation on my OB rotation of yoga, sort of the evidence for yoga and pregnancy and labor. And was curious if you wanted to share, you know, some thoughts about that specific topic or anything of specifically of these articles and the accompanying PDFs that you've been working on.
Yeah, so the pain management is really interesting. One of the reasons I wanted to do something public about that is because I work with a lot of college students. So I still have stayed adjunct and teaching honors students about childbirth. I teach a semester-long class to them. And in talking with young people who are 18, 19, 20 years old, I've pretty much come to the conclusion that they are all so terrified of childbirth. A lot of them will even say that they don't intend to have children because they're so afraid of the pain of childbirth.
Oh,
and
goodness.
So,
wow.
Yeah, so it's really culturally, it makes sense because whenever you have any kind of movie scene or TV scene of childbirth, it's always really terrible, you know, dramatic and intense and violent almost. And so we've kind of been fed all these messages. So people are very scared of the pain. So I was really interested in like addressing that head on. And you know, just really all I'm doing is summarizing what these really amazing researchers have already looked at. And there's some really great systematic reviews on pain management. And I was really surprised to find that when they randomly assign people who are in labor to either have drugs offered first, like immediately go to the drug model, or to have non-pharmacologic methods offered first, and then drugs are offered if they're needed later on, that there were huge health benefits to doing the approach where you offer the non-pharmacologic methods first and then only use drugs if they're, you know, requested or needed. And it was just really fascinating to see that that improved not only their health outcomes, but their satisfaction greatly, which, you know, coming from the medical model, often you think, well, that doesn't make sense. Like you should, you know, fix the pain right away by giving the pain meds.
Yeah.
But what we've found is kind of the opposite, that it's much more empowering to use some of the central nervous system control methods and gait theory control methods that really help not only reduce the pain, but also improve your experience that you're having in your head.
Yeah, you use one of the terms that I've shared quite frequently, the difference between pain and suffering. And I feel like the images that you describe that are put out in sort of popular media, social media, what have you, regarding childbirth are these sort of over-exaggerated, dramatized, and almost, yeah, violent sort of, this violent imagery. And it's almost just sort of like preparing people that this you know, experience is meant to be one of suffering. And it's not that, you know, there's not going to be pain involved, but you don't have to suffer. I, you know, see suffering as a choice. But these images just make it sound like this is going to be the worst experience of your life. And so we're just preparing people for something that you know, could actually be a very different type of experience. And was curious what you see as the difference between, you know, pain or the experience of pain and true suffering.
I think that that point would be reached for anyone. I also want to point out that not everyone experiences pain. I know I focused on that in that series because that's what people are afraid of. But in one research, I think it was in the Somatic Review, they quote a study that I didn't go and pull myself, so I haven't looked at it. But they cited this study and said that 2% of people don't have any pain during labor and childbirth, which I thought was interesting because that's about 1 in 50 people. So, and then we also have, you know, those people in like, I don't know, is it Teen Mom or I Didn't Know I Was Pregnant, these TV shows where people like actually have a baby on the toilet and didn't even realize they were pregnant or in labor. And it just kind of goes to show you that our mind, our central nervous system is very powerful. And I can't remember your original question, but I was just thinking about that. You know, you're talking about pain and suffering, but I don't think we need to frame it that way. I think we should frame childbirth more as like talking about comfort and managing pain. And every person is unique. And some people may reach a suffering point sooner than other people. And it's the thing about maternity care and delivering care during labor and delivery is that it needs to really be individualized to the individual. And that's also what they found in the research, is that when you tailor the approach that how you're going to manage pain to the individual, that the outcomes are better and they're more satisfied and their pain is more effectively managed. But what we tend to do in America and a lot of other countries is kind of just a standardized approach. Everybody walks in, they get the epidural, and they lay on their back for the rest of their labor. And research actually shows that we should be offering more options. And ACOG, the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, actually says everybody should be offered non-pharmacologic methods. I'm not saying that nobody, you know, nobody should take drugs. Obviously, people are going to want them and request them. But one of the problems with our healthcare system is if you walk into the hospital like I did, and you're told to lay on your back in bed, not allowed to eat and drink, and you're basically said, you can have an epidural or you can lay here and suffer in pain. There's actually no other options offered to most people these days. So, you know, what kind of options could be offered? They could be having a birth ball, encouraging them to be up, moving in an upright position, and also getting in a warm tub of water. Very, very few women in the U.S. are ever even offered any kind of water immersion or hydrotherapy during labor. So if your choice is between laying in bed and suffering or having an epidural, most people are going to choose the epidural. But what our system isn't doing is they're not offering them any other options most of the time. So theoretically, it shouldn't be between laying in bed suffering versus an epidural. It should be, here are non-pharmacological methods and here's the pharmacologic methods, you know, and that would be your choice instead.
Yeah, I see it, and I completely agree. Those types of discussions, you know, it's beyond just having those services and non-pharmacologic approaches available, because, you know, the truth is they are being made available, even in, you know, major, you know, academic centers that seem to be, you know, more traditionally minded. You know, those types of services are available, but as you just mentioned, they're not sort of communicated to the patient as that they are an option. And I see that as almost like not being able to give a complete informed consent regarding this experience and, you know, offering risk and benefits and alternatives too. So if I did not, you know, if I choose to do something other than the drugs, what are my other alternatives? And giving full informed consent, we should be, you know, describing what can we offer you outside of these drugs.
Well, and it's not, they are accessible, but not always easily. Like for most healthcare centers, there may be one or two rooms that might have a tub if you're lucky. Theoretically, like it should be like how they do it in some countries in Europe, where every room has a tub and every room has a birth ball and other upright positioning props. And in America, that's more the exception than the rule. So, you know, maybe you'll get there and you're hoping that you can have a tub, but that room is being used right now. So you just, it's too bad. Or maybe often the tubs aren't working.
Or yes.
They're under construction. one really innovative nurse manager that I know, when she really struggled with that because it's really expensive to install real tubs, she just bought a bunch of blow-up tubs and had them available for any, so they could go in any room. You just need a hose to fill it up and you just blow up the tub and plop it in the room. And they're actually kind of more comfortable than the hard rigid tubs.
Yeah.
So, you know, but then you have all of these problems with maybe staff aren't motivated to use it because it's a lot of work to fill up a tub, you know, and to get someone in it. So these things that make labor easier for the birthing person often make it a little bit harder for staff. So there's kind of this disincentive to offer things like water immersion.
This is very true. You know, I know for a fact, I was just, you know, I toured the hospital where I'll be starting my OB rotation, and they very proudly were, you know, showing that they had one tub, and but it didn't seem like it was something that was being used that frequently. And was it because the staff? Was it because the, you know, people didn't know about it? I can only speculate at this point, and be curious to see when I'm there how many people are using it on a regular basis. But like you just said, it's just one. So if you come in and someone has actually chosen to use it, then and that option isn't going to be available. And I mean, I feel like this overall sort of system and these sort of the sort of issues we're bringing up are part of the reason why I feel like, you know, birthing centers and these alternatives to sort of this go to the hospital, have your baby environments, it's why some of these places are becoming more popular. And it sounds like, too, you know, given your research and your work, that people are hungry for this type of information to help support them if they choose to go to some of these alternative birthing centers. And was curious if you wanted to at least provide a sort of basic introduction into what is currently, you know, being, you know, created and available for people who want something other than going to the hospital.
So it really depends on where you live, right? So every state has different laws establishing licensure for midwives and for birth centers. And for example, in my state of Kentucky, there are zero freestanding birth centers, so it's not an option. You can choose a home birth. There are, I think, 4 certified nurse midwives in the whole state that will attend a home birth. Most nurse midwives don't, simply because in some ways it's a lot more work to have a home birth practice because you're always on call. And then also it's, you make way less money. I don't know any wealthy home birth midwives. They're all like, you know, they do it because they're passionate about it, but it's a lot easier. You get better benefits and a better salary if you're in the hospital. And then we also have certified professional midwives in the United States, which are midwives who go directly into midwifery and don't go to nursing first, which is the norm around the world. But in the US, it's a whole interesting political system around, you know, you should become a nurse first and then a nurse midwife. And the whole reason that started was, well, it's kind of a long story, but how it ended up is that not all states have legalized the midwives who went directly into midwifery. And those are the ones who do the vast majority of home births and birth center births in the United States. So they're not even accessible in most, a number of states. I can't remember how many are left, maybe about 20. Where you can't hire a direct entry midwife is what we call them. So there's not a lot of options. It really depends on where you live. Now, there are some states that have a ton of birth centers. California, Texas come to the top of my mind. But then there are a lot of states that don't have any and that are really struggling, and families are really struggling for options. So what I basically try to do and focus in, I have a program where I train professionals, and we also offer classes for parents, like workshops, is basically how to give today's parents the communication and advocacy skills that they need so that when they walk into a hospital setting that doesn't support the options that they want, how do they get those options? Now, obviously, you're not going to be able to really, you know, you're not going to have the perfect scenario, but you should still be able to at least get some of what you want. Even though the system is broken. And so that's really what I'm focusing on. And actually right now I'm piloting a brand new childbirth class that for parents that really focuses on teaching them those skills, not only all of their different options for pain relief, but also focusing on advocacy and how the partner advocate for the person who's giving birth, because obviously they can't always speak when they're in labor. So really teaching dads and partners how to use their voices and how to communicate in the healthcare system. Because when you think about it, most of these people who are walking into hospital to have a baby have probably never been in a hospital in their life, unless it was maybe to visit someone briefly, but they haven't really been at the point where they've been taking care of someone in the hospital. And so I'm trying to teach them a lot of insider tricks that you can use when you're trying to advocate for yourself in the healthcare system. And my hope is that by teaching them this now when they're having a baby, that for the rest of their life, whenever they have encounters with the healthcare system, that they'll be able to use their voice and speak up. And that's really hard for a lot of millennials, especially today, to do, because they've been taught to kind of, you know, an authority a figure is an authority figure and you don't question them. So really working with them on how to speak up.
You bring up so many good points there. I know the first is you pretty much already answered the question I was going to go to of, well, what is the, you know, the next step? Is it trying to make more birthing centers, or is it trying to operate sort of within the system with a sort of new level of engagement and education about the experience? And it sounds like, yeah, it's like, well, we'll take, you know, this is the environment we have. It's maybe not perfect, but let's help to educate and empower so they can have a better experience in that environment. And it's interesting too, you bring up this idea of, kind of the authority figure. I see it too as, I think, you know, for myself, especially in the medical system, in medical school, it can be very intimidating with sort of that hierarchical structure when you see these authority figures to want to speak up. Or if you do, it comes across as being like rebellious. And so it's very extreme. Either, you know, you sit back and you're very quiet, or if you do speak up, it's this sort of like, wait, what's happening here? And it's very hard to find that sort of balance. And I think we need more classes like you're doing, even beyond just for, childbirth. I love how you describe it as like empowering for even experiences in the medical profession and life in general, way beyond just the birth.
It's so true, because birth is just one encounter with the healthcare system. I mean, think as soon as you have a parent develop cancer or Alzheimer's, or, you know, or even a grandparent, maybe recently, one of my relatives was in the hospital and she has dementia, and the doctors wanted to do all this crazy stuff for her heart. You know, it's just like, sometimes you're like, there's not always, I hate to say it, but sometimes there's a lack of common sense, like, and people don't necessarily see the big picture for each patient. Mm-hmm. And you need an advocate there. Anytime you're admitted to the hospital, you need to have someone who is there to advocate for you. Personally, I would have someone with me around the clock if I was admitted. I mean, I can't tell you, even in the emergency room, I've had situations where a nurse brought me a pill that, and she didn't even check armband. She didn't tell me what she was giving me. She didn't ask my name. I had never seen this nurse before. And she just handed me this pill and said, here, take this. And which is, you know, violates everything that we learn in nursing school about safe medication administration. And I'm just like, now I could tell by looking at the pill what it was. I recognized it. So I knew it was right for me. But if you, you know, have cognitive impairment, or even if you're just tired or exhausted, it's so easy for mistakes to happen in the healthcare system. I think it's really important to have an advocate there with you, and learning these ways of speaking up in this kind of hierarchical structure without making enemies. Like,
exactly.
It's all about like, you want that team oriented atmosphere, but still be able to speak up for yourself and your loved ones is so important. I just can't even begin to tell you how many situations I've seen with family and friends who experience things in our healthcare system that you're like, whoa, that's crazy. How did that happen? But, you know, we're all humans and mistakes happen. And it's an institution that you're walking into. And I think you just have to be able to be prepared to build bridges and build a respectful team of everyone who's helping care for you, but also know how to be brave and speak up, which is really hard for young people to do.
So wonderfully said. You know, this has been really, really fun. I want to honor your time. I know we have a few minutes left, and had sort of a couple more questions potentially to ask you. You know, we've maybe been painting a picture that seems a little bit negative. I hope people don't, you know, completely take it like that. I think both of us sort of see that there's, you know, growth, and that actually there's been a lot of good changes, as you were describing earlier. You know, in your childbirth, your baby was taken away. Now, you know, skin to skin contact is the norm in almost every single hospital, which is doing wonders for the health of the mother and the child, and, you know, just growing understanding of the early human, the sort of infant, you know, gut and the health of the gut microbiome. You know, there's so many things that have been emerging and improving for our understanding of the, you know, early moments of this infant's life and improving the experience of the mother. And was curious, I'm sure you've gotten, you know, so many stories from mothers gracious for the information that you've given, and was curious if you just had, you know, one or two stories or reflections that have been given to you because of your work that you'd want to share with us now.
I can think of one story that I have permission to share. It's a mom named Brittany, and she was pregnant with her first baby, and she found out that she was going to have a C-section for this medical reason that there was no avoiding it. And she ended up taking a workshop from one of my instructors. So I have this whole evidence-based birth instructor program where if you're a nurse, midwife, physician, childbirth educator, or doula, you can take this training from me and then teach my classes. And we have this workshop for parents that basically teaches them what I've just kind of explained to you about how to speak up for yourself in the healthcare system and how to navigate that maternity healthcare system. And so she and her partner took this class, and afterwards she said that she felt so empowered that, you know, no matter what type of birth she was having, that she and her partner knew how they could speak up for themselves. And also importantly, one of the things we focus on in our classes is love, because we teach parents that about 1 out of 3 labor and delivery nurses and 1 out of 3 midwives, we don't have stats on physicians, but we do on midwives and nurses, have active symptoms of PTSD from things they've witnessed in the labor and delivery setting. And we basically have the walking wounded taking care of people. And so we spend a lot of time focusing on how can you love your nurse? How can you love your doctor and show love to your midwife? And so she really internalized that with that power of love and the communication skills they learned, that they could speak up for themselves and get the kind of cesarean birth that they wanted. And they were able to do that. And so I thought that was really cool.
That's so wonderful. I'm just like sitting here, you know, you've just, you know, invented, created, started one of the, I think, best recipes for improving physician burnout is let's empower our patients to seek to create love between themselves and their care team. That's just so wonderful to hear, and that she reciprocated and shared that experience with you. And I mean, it sounds like, you know, the outcome of the birth in this case with the C-section was probably not what she initially wanted, but just feeling that no matter what, with that space, coming from that space of love and just feeling like, you know, empowered to be able to speak up, that's so amazing. I'm just really wordless. That's so cool that you're doing that, and I'm, you know, offering that to others who can then go and teach, just expanding that sort of ripple and effect that you're providing. It's wonderful.
There's so many hurting people in our healthcare system, and to me it's one of the biggest, saddest flaws is that in our system is that we don't care for the caregivers. And I've seen that, you know, personally as a nurse. I think one time I got a gift for Nurses Week or whatever. Our hospital gave us each a bottle of Bath and Body Works lotion, but that was the only thank you from the hospital I ever received. And then one time I got a thank you card from a patient who submitted it to the, like, you know, anonymous, you know, where you submit, you write out your evaluation. And he said, you know, Rebecca stayed all night long to make sure I got my blood or something. And it was actually where it was my first shift off orientation as a brand new nurse. And I found out that night, I had worked 11 a.m. to 11:30 p.m. And I found out at 11 p.m. that I was being mandated to stay the rest of the night. And I know as residents, you do that all the time. But as nurses, it's such a physically demanding job that at 12 hours, you know, you're about ready to fall over.
Yeah.
And when I found out I had to stay, and it was really traumatizing. And then I walk into this patient's room that I had been taking care of all day, hung his next bag of blood. And he's like, Rebecca, what are you doing here? It's like 1 a.m. You've been here since yesterday morning. And I was like, it's okay. Don't worry. I'm here to take care of you. And he wrote that thank you. That was the only thank you I ever got from, you know, written from a patient. So I think the caregivers in our system really, it is a very demanding job physically and emotionally. And we have to take care of them, because if we don't treat our own caregivers and staff in the hospital with love and respect, like, how can we expect them to have compassion for patients when they're so burned out themselves? So I do think it's really important. And most parents have no clue, or sorry, patients in the hospital system have no clue that that's going on. So I really believe strongly in educating parents and consumers that we do need to love on our caregivers because of the stressful lives that they lead being in that field.
It's once again so wonderfully said. You know, I've I've said before, it's not, we can't use it as an excuse, but simply trying to increase the awareness in the population as a whole that, our clinicians, our nurses, they're hurting. Like you just said, the statistics just get more and more staggering on the percentages of burnout. And I've spent a lot of my early training and time collaborating with nurses and trying to cultivate resilience and improve just overall well-being. And it's just, we have to increase that awareness, because I think, it's easy to walk in your state of, relative hurt, pain, and suffering as a patient, and forget that, we all have our own battles that we're fighting. And sometimes that's where some of the worst outcomes come, is when two battles are being fought and the other side, each side doesn't see that what's going on. So, whatever we can do to help everyone involved, I think is going to, just improve the well-being of our society as a whole. So, we've done so much in this podcast so far. It's been really wonderful. We've talked a little bit about the articles and you mentioned the website, but I wanted to at least give you this time now to share exactly how, for anyone listening who has started to follow you, how they can get access to the articles and what exactly they can find on your webpage.
Yeah, so just tell them to visit evidencebasedbirth.com. Actually, if you're on Google, you can just start Googling evidence-based, and it usually will autofill in birth as like the second option under evidence-based practice. I'm real happy about that. So we're the most commonly Googled thing after evidence-based practice is evidence-based birth. And if you go to the homepage, there's a form there you can fill out to join our newsletter, and you get, we have 10 free one-page handouts that you have permission to print and share with patients or with other providers or colleagues. And that's what you get if you sign up for the newsletter. And then we also have at the very top, you can click and see our articles, follow our podcasts. And then on the very top, it also says for professionals. And we do have a professional membership. So that's actually what funds. I do have a team of about 7 staff members now that work on everything ranging from graphic design to research to video editing. And so all of the members who join to get professional continuing education, that money goes to support that. So we have a professional membership. We have 20 contact hours for nurse midwives. And we also, all of our online continuing education courses have been approved by the American Academy of Family Physicians for prescribed credit. So you can earn up to 20 hours of prescribed credit through the membership. So I would love to have more physician members. We have about 4 or 5. We have about 500 members in total, but only about 5 or 6 or so of them are physicians. So we'd love to have more physicians join. If you have any physicians who are following in need, contact ours. We also have a private community for our members. So that's where we all interact with each other.
That sounds like a mission and calling for me to expand. I know myself, as I grow and start to experience life in the world of the OB, I would love to get more MDs involved and to expand just that knowledge base. So let's see if we can get more than 4 and 5. I would love to grow
that. And we do have a student. We do have a student scholarship that is also good for medical students and residents. So that's it. Gives you like a huge discount and have a very minimal payment per month to be a member if you're a student or resident. So I just wanted to also let your listeners know about that.
So wonderful, Rebecca. This has been just amazing. And we'll have, for everyone listening, links to the page, and you'll be able to explore everything that she just described. And is there a way that people can get in touch with you specifically, or if they have questions, is that community the best way to reach you?
You can ask me, if you want to ask me personal questions. That private community for members is where I interact with everybody. But also, if you just have a question for our staff, we do have a general email address. It's info@evidencebasedbirth.com.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again. I just look forward to just the continued nourishment that you're going to be providing this space, and just love the new articles and excited for the podcast as well. So thank you, Rebecca, for sharing this time and part of your day to give this to a wider audience.
Thank you, Robert, for having me on your podcast.
Thank you for your presence and willingness to receive a new narrative, a passionate perspective, and perhaps a deeper sense of connection with our collective purpose. Please share this podcast with any and all that you believe will benefit from its intention to relieve one's doing and engage one's being. Please share your comments about the conversation on our podcast page and leave a review in iTunes so that the voices in this space can spread to all ears ready to receive it. Music credit goes to Dillingham for their song Vessel. Remain open, stay curious, and forever be love.
You walked on fire, and I know you tried.